Welcome back to Crime Capsule. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. I don't know about you guys, but I keep a couple items in my car at all times. Granola bars in the glove box, flashlight in the armrest, and a can of WD-40 in the trunk because you never do know when you'll need it. But among the most essential items that I keep on hand is an area guidebook tucked in the pocket behind my seat. If I'm passing through a new town or taking a new route home, I find guidebooks to be way more helpful than snarky, anonymous Yelp reviews, which you can't read while you're driving anyway. The author's been there. They've scouted that breakfast joint out. They've stayed in that B&B. They've met the region's ghosts and witches firsthand. Wait, what? Yeah, you heard me. Depending on where you're going, if you're traveling during spooky season, you've got to know what you're getting into. And luckily, for anyone on the road near Massachusetts or Connecticut these days, we've got you covered. Thomas D'Agostino is the co-author, along with his wife Arlene Nicholson, of New England's Haunted Route 44, just published by the History Press. Arguably one of the most enigmatic highways in the country, full of strange sightings and unexplained events from end to end, Route 44 will intrigue even the most hardened skeptic out on their Sunday drive. In our last featured interview for this extended spooky season, we are thrilled to have Tom join us and take us on a little trip into the unseen. Tom, welcome to Crime Capsule.
Well, thank you. Well, great being here. I'm really excited about this one. This is awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. We are too. Now, you are the author of 17 books and counting, which is a number that still kind of boggles my imagination. We're going to come to those books in just a moment, but before we do so, tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, actually, I grew up in a haunted house, and we... big family.
And nice.
I really loved ghost stories and horror stories, and so did my brothers and sisters. And, it was all those old horror movies and things. Remember the back in Frankenstein and all that? It was really cool. And Edgar Allan Poe remakes, with Vincent Price. And mm-hmm. When I was in college, I was my friend had a house, and he said, "Hey, you want to stay in this house for the winter? Because I just bought it, and I'm going to fix it up in the summer and sell it." So I said, "Sure, I'm in college, just stay in the house." Well, I lasted 6 days because there's so many things were happening. Yeah.
No.
Yep. So many wild things were happening. I couldn't sleep, and I couldn't study. So, that's not good at all for someone in college studying law, physical, political science.
Yeah.
So I turned some of my electives to social sciences and physical sciences and esoterical sciences, even meteorology, just to see why any of this happens. And that was 42 years ago. And lo and behold, after I began to research and investigate after a while, and just found that New England is amazing, and just kept on researching and investigating. Done over 2,000 investigations.
So, let me ask right up front, what did you learn about the house where you grew up?
It was built in the 30s or 40s, but there was just some sort of activity. One of my brothers said it was like a little boy or something, maybe that passed away in the house before we bought it. And basically, he never left. Playing with the toys, a lot of times upstairs where all the, we were where the toys were and everything, so...
So you would not classify this as that kind of malicious poltergeist activity which comes up in some of the accounts in your book? This was a more benign presence, you think, in the house?
Yeah, more or less like wanting to actually play with us.
I mean, who are we to refuse when when the invitation is extended, right?
Yeah, well, you know, when you're a kid, it can get a little unnerving. You don't refuse, you just run or something.
Yeah. Our listeners may hear that my studio cat Snickers has just entered the chambers. She has decided to weigh in on this topic. She's a Halloween colored cat as a tortoiseshell, so she loves spooky season. This is big for her. So, Tom, I mean, when you had this early experience, you had a wonderful introduction, you could say, a crash course, or the kind of the thrown into the deep end, you know, education on the paranormal. How did you decide to formalize that study, right? I mean, because we can have fun going around houses and hearing things and so forth, but when it came time to actually crystallize your knowledge and turn that into a disciplinary pursuit, how did that work?
Well, like, for us, you know, we'd go to like cemeteries or some friends saying, hey, I think my house is haunted. Hey, I think this is haunted. And, well, we'd do investigations, and then I'd research very famous investigators. At that time, there wasn't too many. You had, like, Harry Price, Elliot O'Donnell, you know, and the old-fashioned way of investigating. But I approached it more like, okay, if these are, like, disembodied people, then you should just treat them like people. Like, okay, yep. How you doing? My name's Tom. What's yours? You know, and talk normally. And it worked pretty well, because when you're being friendly and you're not barraging someone with a million questions, who wants to answer a thousand questions and, you know, be like interrogated? And so that became my approach. Then as we got more scientific in the study of it with more equipment, I picked up every, you know, that kind of stuff, and I'd experiment with it, seeing what's real and what might not be, you know, just a fad or something.
You know, it's interesting, because we don't often talk about the kinds of hospitality that we are supposed to show to our unexpected guests, do we?
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like we kind of, we're entering into their space, and, you know, we kind of have to play by their rules. But then there's also that sense of, I love the fact that you kind of said early on, well, I'm not going to bother the ghost if he doesn't really want to be bothered.
Yeah.
That's just so kind of you. That's great. I love it. Well, let me ask you about some of your previous work. I mean, you said 17 books is just marvelous. You've been at this for a long time. I mean, has it all been on paranormal studies, or have you worked in other domains as well?
No, it's all been paranormal studies. My wife, Arlene Nicholson, and I, we've been investigating together for 28 years. And we just, actually, people used to come up, because I'm a musician too, so I'd be playing out, and people would come up and go, oh, I hear you're a ghost hunter. Is there any cool places to go? And this stuff. And I'm like writing directions on napkins and everything. So finally,
nice.
She goes, we both decided, like, we should write a book on this, you know, tell people where to go.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in a good way, of course. And so we got the idea of Haunted Rhode Island first, because that's where we lived. And the publishing company was like, well, we're not really big on it, but we'll give it a shot. And it became the flagship of their some 700 books now.
Wow. Nice. That's awesome. So how is it working with a collaborator, in this case, your wife? But I mean, how do you guys do the kind of, you know, dividing up the research or dividing up the writing, you know, are there things which you sort of segregate for just one person, and then things that you actively kind of shop back and forth on the prose level? How do you guys do that?
Well, yeah, I do a lot of the research, and then I kind of write down, jot everything down, and then we actually go to the places, and Arlene's a professional photographer, so we both go everywhere together. And she'll take pictures of it, of the what we need, and then we'll both do more research on it, and then I'll put it all in the writing, and then she edits it, because she also was an editor for GBH, and then we go back and read it one more time, make sure it's okay, and it goes off to the publisher. So we're both, like, you know, up to our necks in it equally.
Absolutely. All hands on deck at every stage of the process. That's great. Some folks will kind of hive pieces off, you know, to one or the other in collaboration. But I love that sense of like both of you guys are working on every aspect at all times. That's wonderful.
Yeah, we print. Actually, I would print out, you know, what we have as a manuscript. And then when we're traveling to somewhere, she'd be driving and I'd be reading it so we could correct it even then while we're driving.
You got to find those efficiencies, right?
Oh, yeah.
But when you got that deadline bearing down on you. So New England's Haunted Route 44 is the title of your newest book. And it is a thrilling ride, pardon the pun, but it really is start to finish. Just, you know, an incredible adventure. We have had here on Crime Capsule a couple of other authors who have done Haunted Highway series. I'm thinking of Lisa Livingston Martin, who explored Missouri's Haunted Route 66. We've also had Brian Clune, who looked at California's Haunted Route 66 once it hits that kind of far western coast. But this is the first haunted highway that we have had in New England, your neck of the woods, where you were born and raised. Now, you argue pretty early on in the book, I thought this was interesting, Tom, you argue that New England and Haunted Route 44 in particular is the most haunted highway in America. Now, that is quite a claim. Why do you put that out there?
Well, number one, it's 237 miles, and in that 237 miles, you're pretty jam-packed with a lot of places. I mean, it's a road trip that you would be, it doesn't take one day, put it that way. And so it's so jam-packed, it's not like, okay, we got to drive 100 miles to the next site. You know, within 10 miles, at the most, maybe you're stopping going, crap, here I am. Oh, boy. You know, here's the next site, here's the next area. And basically, New England is the most haunted region, as everybody says in the, you know, in the country. And there are claims that people say that Route 44 is the most haunted highway just for one or two haunts alone. They didn't, I don't know if they had any clue of how many are actually along that road.
You know, it's funny because I live here in New Orleans, and, you know, folks love to kind of claim our little patch of, you know, of soil and water as incredibly densely populated with spirits and presences and ghosts and so forth. And it is true. I love the notion that we can actually try to establish a competition. It's very American of us, isn't it? You know, you know, New York, Brooklyn is the most haunted borough, or, you know, like New Orleans is the most haunted city. Like everybody wants a piece of that particular title. But at the same time, one of the things that makes your book so unique in the presentation of that case is that you really back it up. And I love the way that you structure the book. As you travel from east to west, you have these stops, and they come thick and fast. I mean, you really are, as a reader, getting off every 5 to 10 miles, right? Sort of thinking like, and you provide directions, you provide, you know, the addresses, you provide the when to go, and kind of, you know, how to catch everything. And I know exactly what I'm going to do when I get to Connecticut. Now, you know, like I actually have my guidebook in hand, thanks to you and your wife, which is great. Let me ask you. So, you have so many stops in this particular account and in this journey. Did you visit every single one of them yourselves?
Yeah, actually, we visited like 90% of them, because in some cases the places would be closed for the season or something. So I'm like, oh well, we can't tour that. No, but yeah, we took our way through Plymouth and all the other places. I'd say about 95% of the places we were able to actually go visit.
That's awesome. And we're going to come to some specific cases here in a second. But out of all of them, was there one that just really stood out to you as sort of top spooky, right? You know, like took the cake, won the title. you know, just left you feeling so thoroughly unsettled. You were like, this is King of the Hill.
Yeah, in Chepachet, Rhode Island, the tavern on Main, right on Main Street. There's about six spirits or something in there. And we still get calls from people who tell us, you wouldn't believe what happened to us last night there or last week or things like that. It's so active that it's just, I guess, the spirits that are there do not want to leave, but they do want to be noticed.
Well, it being a tavern, maybe the drinks are cheap enough that they're just having such a good time.
There you go.
Who would blame them for you know, not wanting to get kicked out? But, well, let's do this. You start your book. Again, it's a journey. It's a guidebook. It's a, you know, you have this sort of really itinerary-based structure to it, which is great. And you start this journey in Plymouth. Now, Plymouth, of course, has a very rich and storied history, but I thought we could take a look at why you chose to kick things off in Plymouth, first of all, because you say a few things about that in the book. And then we can take a little municipal tour of some of the sites in Plymouth as well. So why did you start it there, Tom?
Basically because, number one, well, it's right on the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, so that's a good place to start. You know, you can't go the other direction. It's basically the birthplace of America, as they call it. You know, America's hometown. Mm-hmm. That's where the Pilgrims finally settled in 1620. And from there, things just went outward and upward and southward.
And one of your arguments, which threads is probably a better word, one of the threads in the book, which is very visible early on, is this notion of when the settlers arrived and they began to make contact with Native American populations, those forms of early contact began to serve as the basis for some of the incidents in your book, right? So the notion of kind of disturbed spirits or you know, presences that did not find peace, whether, you know, they were killed in violent means, I mean, that goes right back to the early 1600s.
Yeah, it's because they came here. They didn't have a construction company waiting to build houses for them. They didn't have a blacksmith saying, okay, I'm going to make you guys some shovels, blah, blah. Things were very, very harsh and brutal. And when they got here in the winter, they actually thought it was going to be as mild as England was. They didn't know the winter was being about, you know, the same latitude. They didn't know that. Is that a year latitude? Well, you know, on the same plane.
Yeah.
They didn't know that, you know, we had very harsh winters here in New England. And so a lot of them did die. You know, it was very tragic. And then you did have some confrontations with the original indigenous people. And on both sides, there was obviously, you know, some tragedies. And the wild animals and all kinds of things. So it was ripe for basically scarring the land for these people who came here to make a peaceful new life.
Yeah. And you also had just the treachery of the elements and the landform and the danger of the coast itself. And there's a fairly dramatic shipwreck, you know, which you describe, you know, that has resulted in quite a lot of activity in in that area. Well, let's start off with the Spooner House. So right at the very beginning, you describe there's a particular residence which has a spirit of kind of very distinctive appearance. So tell us about the Spooner House.
Yeah, the Spooner House was basically... It was in the Spooner family. I mean, it was in the Spooner family until 1954. It was originally built in 1749, but Ephraim Spooner took it over a few years later. But in 1954, James Spooner actually gave it to the Historical Society, and all the artifacts are still there. In fact, he's one of the ghosts, they believe, who is seen in the house because they hear he was a music lover. And they hear music from the period of time he would have lived, as if someone was playing like old 78 records. But Abigail Townsend is the most prominent spirit there. A little girl. She was, I guess she was adopted by the Spooner family. And she died of an abscess tooth infection.
And yeah, of course.
Yeah, and people began to see her. They do walking tours around the Spooner house as part of a big haunted tour. And in one case, this girl, little girl, comes and pulls, tugs, you know, one of the tour people's shirt. And the woman on the tour turns around and says, "Oh, hi." And she goes, "Oh, I got to go now." And she vanishes. Another time, the little girl comes out of what they call the Spooner Alley. It's just an alley between two houses. And everyone's going, "Wow, that's so cool. You have like this actor coming out, you know, making the tour really well." And the tour guide goes, "Well, it's 10 o'clock at night. We don't have little children actors running around." Right. You know? People have seen her like looking out the windows, and a construction crew, when they were doing renovations, this construction crew that had foreman knocks on the door because he couldn't get in. Nobody, they were supposed to leave it unlocked, and I guess they forgot. And this little girl answers the door and walks away. Now, this was like 2005, 2006, so it's not like, you know, he just gets on his cell phone and he goes, "Oh, I came in, the door was locked, but the little girl let me in," to the curator. Curator goes, "We don't have a little girl in the house."
Ooh.
And they went looking into the living room where she walked in, and there's only one way in and one way out, and it was empty.
I don't know. What do you make of it? What do you think's going on there?
Well, you know, it's kind of cool because if she's answering doors and talking to people, that's an intelligent spirit. She may not know she's been long past. Mm-hmm. She's that still lives there.
Yeah, how common is it that, you know, so often the spirits that we encounter, and you write about many of these, they do not actually have the capacity or the agency to interact with the physical plane, right? And so it's kind of interesting, like, you know, you sort of see them as apparitions, or they kind of appear and then disappear into the wall or kind of melt away, but there's never any contact, you know, right, with things. And in this particular case, we're suggesting there's like a, I don't know, a higher gradient somehow of their corporeality. So yeah. How do you make sense out of that if she's able to open a door, if that's kind of the report?
Yeah, it's very interesting because it must be a very, very high, you know, density of energy in that home or in that area around the house or something, for be able to have some spirit like that or ghost actually manipulate items. It's not uncommon. Mm-hmm. We're not really absolutely sure how or why yet, you know, until we can sit down with, you know, go to the other side and hang out with like Elvis and Jim Morrison.
I can't wait, man.
That is, of course, they're dead. Remember, we've heard the rumors. And then come back.
That's true. And Jimmy Hoffa, too, right? Yep, we're going to find out where Jimmy Hoffa finally is.
And then come back and say, "Oh, this is what happens." You know, or invite a ghost to dinner and they actually sit down and tell you, "You know, this is how it works." We're still grasping at straws, so.
Sure. It's an intriguing case because of that higher level of engagement, you know, that you see. Not everybody that you write about has that sort of, you know, feature or what have you. So let's take a look at Spooner House is great. Mm-hmm. Definitely got to visit the Spooner House.
Yeah, they do tours.
You know, that's and I hope that the you know, folks' camera batteries are charged, right? If you know what I mean, because that's always the pitfall. But let's take a look elsewhere in Plymouth. You have a great discussion of the lighthouse and the sort of the Plymouth lights. And this one got me. My father was a Navy man. He was a sailor. Yeah. And, you know, think about the, you know, the early days of coastal navigation where, you know, lighthouses were it, you know, I mean, you didn't have GPS, you didn't have, these kind of modern devices to get you safely up and down the coast. And this particular lighthouse has quite a history behind it and quite an unusual abiding presence. So take us there.
Yeah, the Plymouth Light, which is kind of cool, It was donated. Actually, the land was donated after it was erected in 1769. John and John and Hannah Thomas gave the land, and he was the lightkeeper. Him and his wife from 1769 when it was first erected to 1776 when actually he became a casualty of the war. That the impending revolution, and then Hannah took over. She was officially the first woman lightkeeper in America.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah, a fort was erected near there, but it was kind of cool because one of the British ships fired on the fort, but I guess they missed and they hit the lighthouse.
Whoops!
Yeah,
probably a more strategic decision, even if in an accident, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. But, yeah, it was kind of cool because it started out with two lights, and then they tore one down. It was just, you know, there was, like, not necessary to have two of them, so they tore them down and made one light. And, obviously, it was, like, a lot of these lighthouses, they build them close to the water, but they come to find out erosion threatens their existence. So this one had to be moved in 140 feet, like, several of them had to be doing that. But Hannah... being the first lightkeeper and very brave and very, I guess, dedicated to her job, has never left the lighthouse.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
People can stay there. In other words, there's a lot of lighthouses in New England you can actually stay overnight at, like a bed and breakfast.
Ah, nice.
And this basically was one of them. And Hannah shows up and when the people are sleeping and. She'll tug on the covers. She's looking over you. She'll just, you know, whatever. She just likes to make herself known. And she obviously is still there.
Yeah. I was reading that particular passage where you describe... It's a little unsettling, Tom. I have to say that you've had guests at the bed and breakfast who, you know, one of them wakes up and sees the figure of a woman simply standing over the bed watching, you know, the other one sleep, and then she disappears. I don't know if I could ever go back to sleep again for the rest of my life if I were to see something quite like that.
Yeah, she was known to do that. We've actually had instances where people have told us that kind of thing happened a lot. One person will wake up and there's the next one, you know, they'll look next by them and there's somebody standing looking at their wife or their husband or, you know, the significant other, boyfriend, girlfriend. Yeah. And, it is kind of freaky, especially when they vanish. And the other person had no clue of it. You know, I don't know if I'd say, hey.
No clue.
The ghost was just looking at you and hanging out with you. I don't think I'd want to tell the other person.
Yeah, I would wonder. I mean, is Hannah worried here that, like, maybe these folks are going to try to take her job? Is that the concern? what do you think's going on?
I don't know, because she wanders the grounds in. Like, maybe she's wondering, what the heck are these people doing here? This is a lighthouse, not a inn.
Yeah, no, right. Is she expected to be the one to prepare breakfast? I don't think so. Now, this one is really interesting because it does tie directly back to that Revolutionary War history of Plymouth and the eastern Massachusetts. Now, you have this discussion of this shipwreck, this really significant shipwreck that took place right off the waters there of the General Arnold. Now, how did that shipwreck contribute to the paranormal activity in this area?
That was amazing because there was a few ships there, but the General Arnold was docked with them, and a storm kicked up. Of course, it was in December. But what happened was the same night that Benedict Arnold decided to turn traitor, this ship crashed in the bay and didn't completely sink. It only sank up to the people's knees and waist in some cases. And
ooh.
Yeah, and that's what made it so even horrible because Now, Captain James McGee had a lot of liquor on the ship. Is telling everyone, pour the liquor into your boots, pour the liquor into your pants, you know, so you don't, your legs don't freeze. But a lot of them opted to drink it instead to try and stay warm, and many of them froze.
You're not supposed to do that. Yeah. You're not supposed to do that. Yeah. Nope, nope, nope. That's the wrong way to go.
Yeah, thins your blood. But
yeah, and it brings the heat. It brings the blood closer to the surface of the body, which radiates heat away from the core. So
yeah,
it's bad news. Bad news.
Well, what I mean, it took a while, several days, but they finally were able to make an ice bridge out to the ship, where most of the our soldiers had frozen to death, and they brought them back to the old courthouse. And James McGee and several others lived, but these people, they were buried in the Plymouth burial ground with a monument. Now, he never forgave himself for what happened, even though it wasn't his fault. But he requested to be buried with them when he died. Now, he was, you know, given a wealthy compensation and everything. He gave a lot of his money to the survivors, feeling bad for them. But these, because of that, that one area of the burial ground is very haunted. People see mists floating about. People, you walk over there and you automatically get the feeling like, wow, this is a lot of energy in this part of the burial ground. And it's not not totally negative, but it's certainly not positive at all.
Right, right. And right, when you have an untimely death or when you have a wrongful death, even if there's no one directly to blame for it, you know, the idea is that you still have some kind of disturbance in a person's you know, remains of their psyche or their spirit, which is hanging around, and it's just unresolved, right? Like, yeah, they died before their time.
Well, you got now, 72 men. I mean, like 72 of them.
That's a lot. No account of, you know, paranormal history in the region, of course, would be complete without a tour of such graveyards, and you do spend a good bit of time in Plymouth burial ground, and you write that there are sort of spirits spanning multiple eras in American history which are still found there. How much time have you spent kind of traipsing around Plymouth burial ground, Tom? Is that one of your kind of favorite spots for yourself to haunt?
There you go. Yeah, it is a cool place. I mean, being from New England, we've been to, Arlene and I alone have been to Plymouth, I don't know, 15 times, you know, in the last 15 years. So the burial ground is always a must because it spans, I mean, such a long amount of time. It's not like these burial grounds that were started in 1860 or 1880 or something like that. This thing goes back to the very first settlers being buried there, right up to, you know, there's some areas where there's newer graves. So, you know, the burial ground, you have also, there was the old fort there. And during King Philip's War, which ended around here in 1676, they brought back King Philip's head, and they put it on a pole there near the burial ground.
Oh.
As well as Chief Anawan and Tisquipin, all three of them, met the same fate. So now you have these Indian curses and spirits. Then you have the ghosts of the General Arnold from 1770s, and then you have one other one that there's several others that are seen about. So this is like, wow, this is like a big party of, you know, American history over here running around.
There really is. It's kind of great when you think about all those overlapping you know, entities and eras. I was quite taken with your, it's a brief discussion in the burial ground section, but I was quite taken with your account of the descendant of the Mayflower sort of company, Mr. Thomas Howland or Holland. I wasn't quite sure how to say it, but
yeah, Howland,
I mean, he was one of the Howland. Yeah, I mean, we love a good curse, you know, that leads to that's like the guy committed this terrible act, he got cursed for it, and he got what was his, you know. I mean,
yeah, he wanted this woman's land, and he was going to get it, and they called her Mother Crew, and they thought she was a witch, but but anyway, so he took the land, and he found a way to get the land, and She said, I'm going to have that land. And she goes, well, you better make your peace because you will not see or live to see another sunset. And he's like, yeah. And she said, they'll dig your grave on Burial Hill within you. And he's like, yeah. Go away, old lady. And yeah, he fell from his horse and died right after that.
And there it is.
And he was buried at Burial Hill. And then there's one I like about Ida Elizabeth Spear. The little girl who died in 1860.
Yeah, tell us about her.
And she's buried up there. So this is cool. You got graves going from like 1660 to 1860 and further. But her parents, Thomas and Elizabeth Spear, still go visit her to this day.
Really?
Yeah, they're seen walking up by Summer Street up the path of misty figures. Sometimes people can't make out their legs. And other times you can just see them almost like they're real. Maybe it depends on what the weather is or something, the pressure zone, the energy pockets. But yeah, they just float solemnly up the path right to the site of her burial where they stand there for a second and vanish.
Now, do we have any – these accounts are very well documented. I mean, you write that you have – systematically kind of investigated these, and these are not, coming out of nowhere. You have multiple witnesses, you have different kinds of attestations and so forth. Do we have any visual record, any photographic, kind of evidence of these figures at any point? Because some of our previous authors, have been able to capture some ambiguous looking things on film where it really is kind of hard to say.
Yeah, I would love to have any photographs like that. If I had them, I would have put them in the book immediately, and say, you be the judge, that type thing. Unfortunately, very little that you can find, or, sometimes if you do, like, there's a ghost looking out that window. No, it's the way the light's hitting the rolled glass, blah, blah, blah. People, but to get a photograph of like misty figures wandering up a hill would be awesome. Then someone might say it's just Photoshop,
right? Which is all the rage these days is to put something out there which could go either way, and then say let the people decide. It's pretty good for generating hype on social media if you've seen some of the same stuff I have. Let's take a look at one more. We haven't even left Plymouth, which is amazing. There's so many cases that are just in this one town. We are going to leave Plymouth next week. We're going to travel down the highway to investigate some of the most amazing cases. I'm super excited for that. But let's look at one more from America's birthplace, as you call it, and it's an unusual one because it's got sort of layered in its telling. You have what's called a true vampire story. You have what's called the Vampire Scare of New England, which took place, I guess, about a decade or two after the Revolutionary War, in the sort of turn of the century between the 1700s and 1800s. And here we actually have an account which is contemporaneous to the time of the incident, right? I mean, you actually have an account from those 200 years ago. And we should note, it's very important to note, this was before Edgar Allan Poe was penning his tales further down south. I mean, this is a good, 30 to 40 years, before his work began to really circulate and inspire the ghostly and the macabre in his readers. So take us to this vampire scare in Plymouth County.
Yeah, 1784 is the first documented that we know of someone being exercised for vampirism in New England. And it did last over 100 years with hundreds, if not thousands, of families. It was tuberculosis, what they called consumption, which would make a person pale, gaunt. They'd be coughing up blood. They looked like they were vampires. Well, people didn't think that the person was rising from the grave. They thought the spirit of the person was rising from the grave. And a case that took place in 1807 in Plymouth was pretty interesting because it took the whole family. The whole family died of, consumption. But it was written about, a guy wrote about it in 1822 in the... And this was really interesting because it was the first issue of the Old Colony Memorial in Plymouth County Advertiser, which was May 4th, 1822, where he says about 15 years ago, a whole family was seized by this consumption until there was only a few members left. When the mother was there and then the son, and what happened was, well, the girl about 16 years old, she had died, and what they figured they had to do was an exorcism for vampirism. So they dug up all of them, and they dug her up, and what they did, they instead of, the typical thing in New England was to cut out the heart, liver, lungs, and burn it.
Ah.
Because they believed that.
Because that's just the done thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that way if the body was in whole... Even if it's, in the ground decomposing, it would still feed on the family members. In some cases, they actually fed those ashes to the sick. But in this case, they decided to turn her upside down so she would get confused, and instead of rising up out of the grave, she'd keep digging herself deeper. And the cure didn't work because the rest of the family died, but it's cool because the writer of the article writes a wicked cool poem. This is a great poem, but in the end, his last words were, "The living was food for the dead."
Yeah. Yeah, that was a pretty wicked cool poem. I was really into that poem.
Yep.
Would you actually, Tom, as we close out here for this week, would you be so kind as to read that poem to us so we can get a sense of, the fear, the uncertainty, the doubt, the horror that was circulating in those days?
Yeah, sure. This was a recollection, actually, too. So it wasn't like I'm just making this up, the guy or whoever. It was a recollection. I saw her. The grave sheet was round her. Months had passed since they'd laid her in the clay. Yet the damps of the tomb could not wound her. The worms had not seized on their prey. Oh, fair was her cheek as I knew it. When the rose, all its colors were brought, in that eye, did a tear then bedew it, gleamed like a herald of thought. She bloomed, though the shroud was around her. Locks of her hair, cold bosom wave, as if the stern monarch had crowned her. The fair speechless queen of the grave. But what lends the grave such a luster? Over her cheeks what beauty had shed? His life blood, who bent there, had nursed her. The living was food for the dead.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
that hits on so many levels.
Yeah, very.
And, I gotta say, I mean, as one who writes and publishes poetry, I am very impressed with the rhyme "luster and nursed her." That is a champion slant rhyme right there.
Oh yeah,
Emily Dickinson, eat your heart out.
Right? Well, yeah, really tough to find something to rhyme with luster.
Yeah, it is. It's sort of like you could go muster with the troops, in a battalion, but no, the register doesn't work there. It's a totally different domain. But the fair speechless queen of the grave. Ah, perfect. This is great stuff, man. This is great.
Very
great
illustrious
stuff. Very indeed. Edgar Allan Poe, sit and take some notes here. This is great. Well, thank you for taking us to haunted Plymouth this week. This has been pretty chilling. I'm not sure I'll be sleeping very well tonight, but we're going to try. If I wake up and find any ghostly light keepers standing over, my bed, you'll be the first to know.
There you go.
Man, that's quite a lot. We will come back next week and we will get in the car and we are going to start driving west along New England's haunted Route 44. Thank you so much for joining us this week, Tom.
Oh, thank you. It was quite a pleasure.
All right. Thanks for listening. Now, before we go, today I wanted to introduce you to a new show from our network, Evergreen Podcasts, called Countdown to Dallas, a podcast about the Kennedy assassination. On the 60th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, former White House correspondent Paul Brandis takes an in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to that infamous afternoon in Dallas, Texas. He explores the troubled and broken life of Kennedy's killer, Lee Harvey Oswald, and challenges 6 decades worth of conspiracy theories, none of which have been proven. Learn more about Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Thanks again. Our guest here on Crime Capsule has been Tom D'Agostino, co-author along with Arlene Nicholson of New England's Haunted Route 44, published by the History Press. To order a copy of the book, visit your local independent bookstore or visit arcadiapublishing.com. Join us next week as we continue our conversation with Tom, and he takes us to some of the scariest spots along the scenic drive. Tune in to hear your host wimp right the heck out. See you then. Thanks as always to our producer, Bill Huffman, our production director, Bridget Coyne, audio engineer, Ian Douglas, and our executive producers, Michael DeLoya and Gerardo Orlando. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. Crime Capsule is a production of Evergreen Podcasts and a signature title of the Killer Podcasts Network. You can find Crime Capsule wherever you listen to podcasts. Discover more great true crime and paranormal programming at killerpodcasts.com.
My name is Cindy Burnett, and each week I interview at least 2 traditionally published authors on my podcast, Thoughts from a Page. We talk spoiler-free about their books, so you can listen whether you have read the book or not. And then we delve into things that you most likely won't hear about anywhere else. The importance of the cover design, why they included various aspects of the story, personal details about both the books and the authors' lives, and so much more. You can find the podcast on every major platform and learn more about it on my website, thoughtsfromapage.com. Thanks so much for checking it out.